Hello, Debbie Lynn.
Hi, Derek. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I always like to talk to someone who has twisted, demented ideas they incorporate into a film.
There we go. All right. Well, this will be a good chat. How's life on your end?
It's not bad. How about on yours?
Very good, thank you. Very good, thank you.
Well, it should be. You have put together a really interesting and entertaining film, and a lot of people might not...
Interesting and entertaining.
It is interesting and entertaining. I love the premise. We go from a gulag out into the mountains. We're dealing with snow. We're dealing with rocks, cliffs. This was not an easy shoot for you, I suspect.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So that begs the question, what was in your head to make you want to do this film and come up with this story?
Well, you know what, the initial kernel of the idea goes completely to, I got to give full credit to James McDougal. He's the lead actor and the co-writer, one of the co-writers, and he really wanted to be like, he saw The Revenant, and he wanted to be Leo in The Revenant. And I think he really wanted that acting opportunity. He's like, I want to be the lead. I want this meaty, juicy role that I can really stick my teeth into, no pun intended. And and then he, in researching some sort of dark Russian history, I really don't know how he came across it. I don't know what that guy looks at on the internet at night. But he came up with this story of the walking supply, that it is a true story, that back in the gulags in Russia, World War II, that was a concept that would happen. They would bring along an extra prisoner as a potential walking supply. And he's like, oh my God, I'm fat? I could be the walking supply. So he came up with that kernel. And honestly, everything evolved from that, because we'd done some short films. We had a bit of camera gear. I was working in stunts for about a decade leading up to this point. And it really came up to, like, we had this idea of a story, this kernel of an idea. We had a bit of gear, and I had a bit of, you know, a bit of know-how in the stunt world. And it just came, like, what could we create? What kind of cinematic moments, what type of, like, emotional impact moments could we put on camera and create properly? And really, it became almost a matter of just, like, throwing a bunch of wild ideas at the wall and seeing how it sticks, and then finding the through line, and then really just, you know, figure out how it relates to the characters. And yeah, that it was just this wild journey that created that film. And we really almost made a point of not taking the easy path on anything. We were like, no, if this film's gonna get on the map, we knew we wouldn't have the budget to get on the map. We're like, let's just put every bit of effort, passion, and energy onto the screen, and we'll see how it shakes out. That's what you got.
Well, what I really love here is, yeah, this could have been a traditional, you know, we're escaping a gulag and we're trying to get to freedom and civilization, just facing the hardships of the weather and the locale. But then you and James add that incredible gross out twist that I think will freak people out when they see it. They will not expect it until it happens. And it is done so viscerally and vividly that you cannot look away. It's like a five-car pileup on the freeway. You cannot look away. Was all of this scripted in there? Were you thinking of visuals while in the writing process with James, and also when Doug was brought in as well?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. 100%. And you know what? One thing I think we did really well, and this is just a gut feeling that I think paid off immensely, is that we brought a few key crew members in nice and early, or at least we consulted with them nice and early, and that came from, like, the key makeup and prosthetics artist, Carly Morris, who's an Emmy Award-winning prosthetics and makeup artist, who we just happen to know. We've worked with her on smaller projects, and she absolutely brought her A-game. Everything looks incredible, so... We had this concept, and I consulted with her earlier, like, can we achieve this? How can we do this? And we wanted to make sure that she had the time to do her job properly. And that was one of those ones where, like, we had this idea, we had this intense, grotesque idea of him, you know, getting a piece of meat that they then take it back. And it's funny, I actually consulted, this is a fun little side story you might enjoy. I actually consulted I talked to my chiropractor and like a massage therapist, and like we're trying to think like what chunk of meat could you take off the human body that a person could survive from and keep functioning. Like, I think it terrified them. They didn't respond to me, and I had to go back and see them in person. Like, yeah, I'm not actually going to do this. By the way, this is for a story. I should make that clear. They were terrified, but yeah, it was very critical. Like, make sure the story was clear, that the terror was there, that the stakes raised immensely. Like, we wanted that midpoint to have, as you said, that visceral feeling when once you see this happen, you know, like the stakes have raised to just such an intense level that he's in a whole other world all of a sudden, and that all the dynamics have shifted on a dime. I think we got it.
I think you definitely did. It's such a surprise because we've already had Victor, and I have to say that Ian Matthews as Victor is wonderful. Such a key character. He's not in the film for a long time, but he's in long enough that he makes a difference because he has already tipped Henry off that, well, you're sick. If you can't make the climb, they're going to get rid of you. So that's what you're expecting, because poor Henry, he's sweating, he's feverish. He's not doing good after taking that plunge into the icy river. So you think that he's not going to recover, and they're going to kill him, and it's going to be an adventure tale with just Kurt and Anthony. So I love how you then give us that spin, because the setup is there for one thing, and then we go another direction. So it's a great diversion tactic.
I'm glad that landed that way for you. I'm smiling ear to ear right now. I'm very happy that played off that way for you.
I really love how that played out. It took it from being a tradition, an expected, we're escaping the gulag and we're crossing frozen rivers and mountains to get to civilization, which that in and of itself would have been interesting, but how long would it hold the eye of the viewer for an entertainment factor?
Yeah, that was the goal. And I think a big part of this too, and I'm so happy with the way that, that Saban is marketing this, is that we really want it to be unclear as to who the protagonist of this is.
Yeah.
Basically until the midpoint, and it's kind of a tricky balance because you want to relate to your protagonist, you want to connect with them and get to enjoy them. And we really try to find that fine balance of being like slightly annoyed by this guy, but we also want you to relate to him. You know, you're like, you never want a protagonist that you don't enjoy. That's terrible. But we wanted you to kind of empathize with them, but be kind of like, oh, if you get rid of this guy, he's useless. And then suddenly you see the use that they have with them. And I'm hoping that, in one fell swoop, we're suddenly going to get just this, like, overwhelming sense of empathy for him. And, like, it just seems like he has absolutely no chance against this guy, but he finds his way. And I think if you listen closely, I think a lot of, like, the little subtle lessons he learns from Victor along
yes.
the ways, and even from his antagonists along the ways, kind of see him through to the end of the story.
Well, and it's once Victor tips him off, he was then determined to defy their intentions. So Henry really stepped up his game, no matter how difficult it was. And instead of being, so wishy-washy, mamby-pamby, and scared of his own shadow, he really upped his own ante and worked.
Yes.
And I gotta say, James as Henry, you fall in love with Henry very early on, because he's the guy, and he's so excited when somebody comes to him and says, well, we can get out of here, but we need you to go steal keys and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, I'm going to be part of the gang. Because he's not really the outdoorsy kind of macho guy kind of type. And to see him, his ebullience being included and then being tortured, so to speak, and then but he gets to go on this great adventure to civilization. You just love with every foible as he's struggling to keep up and he's hanging back because he just can't maintain their pace. You just love him more and more and more as the film goes on.
Awesome. I can't say, I'm literally smiling ear to ear. I said already, like, this, I'm so happy that you connected with him that way. That means a lot to hear. And this is great. Like, we wrote this quite a long time ago, and, like, we've had these, like, are people going to pick up on this? Are people going to realize? So, hearing this word, and I'm looking you up right now. Like, I've got a bunch of web pages, like internet windows open with all the work that you've done. And so I gotta say, it really means a lot hearing these words from you. This is very cool. This is very exciting to hear.
And he sustains, we care, we are so invested in Henry as this journey goes on. But similarly, you did a great job of casting, bringing Joel LaBelle in as Anthony, because he is also quite sympathetic. And you see him, he's there with Kurt. He's going along with him, but even he starts to see that Kurt is somewhat of a nut job. And you see his, Joel's got really great facial expressions.
Oh, yeah.
So that conveys so much without him saying anything that would indicate that he's questioning Kurt and his quote-unquote leadership. I really love the performance. You did a great job casting Joel in that role, and I love that performance and how that progresses. And here again, you give us a twist with that character. We get to a certain point and you think, okay, he's a good guy. He's looking out for Henry. He's talking to him about his wife back home and his wife Lily and his daughter. And he's along for the imaginary remembrance built off the corner of a photograph. And then turns on a dime and shocks the hell out of you. So you did an excellent job with the casting and putting people into these roles that really embrace the characters as they are written.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Oh, I was going to say, finding the cast, we got so lucky, because figuring out who could play Anthony was such a tricky number, because we needed someone who you believed the menace. You needed someone that we could believe that he was like a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And like, you want to be intimidated him off the top, but at the same time, like, when he has that change of heart, it had to be subtle. It had to be believable, because it has to happen in front of Kurt's eyes, yet it'd be subtle enough that Kurt may not notice, but like sincere enough that Henry knows that he's got to get through.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel, funny enough, he's a good friend of mine. He's a dear friend of mine. He's a fantastic actor and a wild daredevil and an excellent stunt performer, and now a great stunt coordinator as well. And he had the skill set, and so when I sent him the script, I just said, hey, read it. Just give me your thoughts. As a friend, give me your thoughts. And he read it, and he's like, man, I am shocked at how good the script is. And I got to say, that Anthony character, oh, my God, that is juicy. And it's funny, the dialogue that's written is written with his voice in mind. Like, he's quite a character in real life, and so I wrote this with his voice in mind, and we all wrote this, and I kind of like tweaked it a little bit, really leaning into Joel's voice, because he's a wonderful human. And it's funny, he just happened to connect, and he happened to resonate with that character. I'm like, that's funny you say that, man. I was really hoping you'd play him, and everything just lined up beautifully. He came out, and he knocked it out of the park.
How important was it for you in casting, not just the principal parts, but the supporting players and all, because of the amount of stunts that are here, and then when we get the guys out there on their own in this really rugged terrain and cold, how important was it to have actors that could do at least some of their own stunt work, if not most of it, for the authenticity factor?
It's absolutely integral, and I'm glad you asked about that, because really a lot of this was written around what we knew we could get out of people. Like, the stunts were very specifically written for what we could accomplish with the performance we have, because we didn't want to do the conventional. I mean, well, you know, once in a while, you have to do the close-up of your actor, you cut to your stunt performer on the wide. But what we really wanted to do was, like, see the person going through the trauma, going through the adversity, and seeing them really struggle through this, because it's, you know, a wide shot of a stunt is great to see. I've made my career off it. It's awesome. But it's really when you can connect with the person, the actor and the character going through that, that's what I think really connects with an audience member. You know, and I think that's what Tom Cruise taps into. So, like, seeing, like, really, like, the ice fall, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We had James McDougal doing ice baths for, like, a year almost leading up to this shoot. Like,
wow.
He was doing them over and over and over again, so that when you see that is quite genuinely James McDougal falling face first through ice into a frozen lake. That is really happening in front of your eyes, you know. And when we see them on the edge of the cliff, those are the performers at the edge of a cliff. We actually had them there, and everything was written around what we knew we could get out of those guys. And we rewrote scenes based on what we could do. We had the location scale. We had to find the perfect cliff that had the height and the and like that, that kind of like immense foreboding presence, but at the same time was a cliff that James could climb up. Like he's not a small dude. Like mm-hmm. we need to make sure he could get up it because we wanted him up that cliff, and that is him, you know, 60 feet up on that rock face, dangling off. Shots.
I'm willing to bet that it was not him tumbling down in the third act, rolling all the way down.
You know what? For some shots it is. For some shots, and I'll tell you a fun story. For some shots it is, and he was so keen. He's like, let me do it. And I was like, dude, I believe you want to, and I believe you'll try, but we need to finish the movie. So we have stunt doubles for a few shots because we just, you know.
Yeah, you had to.
Movie. We had to. So a few shots, we've got the stunt double. Like some good friends of mine came out, they did stunts for it. But then towards the very end of the film, once we had really nothing left, where there were a couple shots, I'm like, all right, James, go in, man. You want to do it? Go for it, man. Okay. And so he did a couple of like pickup shots where he was like rappelling down the mountain and like slamming against the tree, and he may have broken a rib or two. Like, we're not even
oh
sure.
My, Derek. Ah.
Oh, I know. But you know, I say that he's one of my best friends, and I was like, if you really want it, man, you go for it. You gotta watch out for this. He went in, and he was like, oh, I was filming that for a couple weeks, and he didn't break a rib. He was hurting for a week or two, but he was very keen to try, and he got a very hearty reminder as to why you hire stunt professionals.
Yes.
When you let the actors go a little too far, things can go wrong. That's honest.
Yeah, and then the insurance company isn't happy with you.
Exactly. So this was sort of like once we were done, the movie was finished, he's like, do me a favor, we're doing pickup shots, just a couple of us out there. We're like, all right, man, hey, if you really feel like it, go for it. Yeah, oh. we realized why it was a very good idea to bring in stunt performers for the earlier season.
Yeah. What location? Where was this shot? Because the location is just fabulous and it's a character unto itself in the film.
I thank you for saying that. And you know what? This is something I put more time in editing. I said to a few people where I think our production design budget was, we did have a wonderful production designer for some of the prison work. But for everything after they get out of the prison, the production design budget was basically me driving around for weeks on end trying to find the perfect landscape that captured the scene or the setting and the mood. And we shot between Hamilton, Orillia, like in, I don't know if you know Ontario very well, but like we shot over like, it would take you 8 hours to drive to all the different locations. Actually, no. About 12 hours to drive to all the different locations. We filmed that in Ontario. And then we went to Calgary and we filmed 4 hours north of Calgary at the Saskatchewan River crossing, just south of Jasper.
Wow.
And that was just for a couple key scenes. And it was literally like, I could show you my Google Maps where I've just gone through and I've just kind of picked different little spots where I would just hike up different trailheads. I would go 10 minutes up every trailhead that would catch my eye. And some of them just had the right feel, the right vibe that I felt really evoked the scene and the story and the feeling we were trying to film. There's one great bill in the DPR. There's one that reported at the end of the day where we went to film. We were hoping to kind of squeeze one shot to a certain scene, or into a certain shooting day, I should say. And we went to shoot. I'm like, these aren't the right trees. And I think the office was snickering. They were kind of laughing at me, like, oh, okay, director needs better trees. Okay. But no, I did. I needed the right trees. And we went to a different spot, and we found that it was the right weather, we were at the right time, and we had the luxury of, you know, James and I, again, being really good friends. We were able to go out and just find the right time of, we found the right location, we just drove out, and it's just this one shot where after he realizes that Victor's fallen off the cliff, and he realizes, like, the trouble that he's really in, and it's just this low-angle shot where we come up, and you just see the trees just swaying above him,
mm-hmm.
like just ghosts, almost like taunting him above. It's in the trailer, and I can't tell you how many hours of driving and makeup and everything went into getting that one shot, because we just didn't have quite the right vibe for that, but then we found it, and I thought that just absolutely spoke to me, and we were all like, nope, this is worth it. This just captures that. So many moments where we put in so much time to just get the right location with the right feeling that really set the right tone. I can't tell you how happy I am with what we got.
So now finding all these locations, remote locations and dangerous locations, how did this impact your poor cinematographer, Russ, in terms of equipment, in terms of camera? Obviously, the lighting, you're using natural light, especially when you're outdoors, obviously. How did this impact him and you working with him to develop a visual grammar where he had some kind of agility and nimbleness?
I'm glad you asked that as well, because so we had about 21 days of principal photography. Really 20 days, we got rained out for one day. and where we had a couple Aries, we had a crew that was between, you know, 30 to 50 people, depending on the day. And then we had a handful of what we called micro-unit days, where it was somewhere between 2 and 15 people. I'd say 2 and 20. I'd say 2 and 20 people. And, like, when we did the ice fall, we had a safety team there and everything, so we had a larger footprint that day. But there were some days like that tree shot I just mentioned. It was literally James and I, James McDougall and I. That was it. And so I was actually the DP for a lot of that. And so with Russ, like, he was just brilliant. I really, like, we had the main principal photography days where he's a genius. He's shot a million different projects. He knows how to make things so great right off the bat. And it really, like, I tried to kind of, like, I'm like, a lot of times it would be us running out with the gear trying to, like, evoke the same, like, visual grammar. As you said, that was perfect. Like, we were really trying to capture the same vibe, make sure this all fit into the same look and feel, and, like, it was our challenge to try to, like, really match the same vibe. But what was great is that it wasn't, like, show up at these locations, try to make it work. The locations were picked based on how they looked, and not just how they looked, but that how they looked and what time of day we would be filming at. Like, there's one shot where he's ice fishing, and everything was based very specific. I'm looking at the location as we speak, actually, and we had everything set where we would film in the morning of them starting off, we'd go and shoot something else, and we'd come back, and we knew exactly where the sun was going to set, so that we could be out there on the ice in a, like, -25 degrees Celsius that day. And, like, when you see him pull a little hook out of the water at that point, there's all the ice hanging from it, that is absolutely real. And it was freezing cold that day, but we knew where we were shooting, what time of year we were shooting, where the sun was going to be. It was all based off of all of that. So, yeah, the look and the feel were really, they were considered from the script point. Like, we only wrote what we knew we could shoot, and we had locations that would lend themselves to the scene. This is kind of a, we sort of reverse engineered this thing from the beginning, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes sense. What cameras were you using for this one?
So principal photography was done on two RE Alexas. And then we would use a red Gemini for some the micro-unit shots, red Komodo for a lot of stuff as well. It was just smaller and easier to do some of the handheld stuff. And then the DJI 4D had come out shortly before then as well. So there's certain scenes where we're, like, running through the canyons. Like, there's, like, a snowy canyon that Kurt and Anthony chase Henry through. And it's funny. I have a shot that's, like, a 20-second version of that. It really didn't play into the scene. We ended up just, it felt better just cut into it faster. But we have all sorts of, like, fantastic shots where I'm just running full tilt with the camera behind me, and this thing's able to sort of, like, smooth it out, like, with its, like, built-in gimbals fantastically. And so that was a very key component. It actually had low ISO, or sorry, I should say, it had a fantastic dual ISO setting so that we were able to capture these, like, nighttime shots wonderfully. There's a key shot. I'm not sure what you'll post or not, so I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a key shot towards the end of the film where Henry's sitting by a fire.
Yeah.
With the mountains in the background. I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about.
I do.
And again, that exact location was picked almost a year before filming. That was that spot north of Calgary. They're like, this is the place we need to film. And it was a matter of, if we went out with the red camera, I remember if I went out with the Gemini to capture the shot that I wanted, we would have had to travel with dolly track, a dolly, a jib arm, Ronin two stabilizer, remote, like, follow focus unit, all these things, or a carry-on size Ronin 4D that I just walked backwards through the trees with, and it did everything for me.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing. So for remote shooting, the red Komodo and the DJI 4D were integral to that. They just kind of, like, just for, like, the kind of, like, rugged, like, far, like, the remote locations, being able to film in those areas, it was absolutely integral.
You are also the editor on this film. Now, were you editing
correct
as you were shooting, or did you wait till you had all your footage and then start your editing assembly?
You know what? A bit of both. There were certain sequences that were, like, for, like, more sensitive locations where I'd have to, like, put the edit together quickly so we knew, like, what kind of shots we needed before we lost access to certain shots. But I have to say that was a godsend. Being the editor and having, with the actors being, like, closer friends, That helped a lot, like knowing I had access to these people to get little pickup shots.
Sure.
We knew that going in. We knew going in, let's get everything we can on principle. We kind of knew that we weren't going to get everything, but we could come back and get a couple pickups. Like, that was part of the game plan. And, oh my goodness, I have to say, like, sometimes you read that, like, oh, a certain film went back for pickups, or this major blockbuster film had to go back for pickups, and some people are like, oh, something went wrong. It's like, no. And actually, if you listen to the Russo brothers' interviews, they plan on this, and I think it's fantastic, because you could spend forever figuring out the exact little pickup shot that you need to really tie something in, and then you're spending forever wasting your time on a main unit shoot day trying to find these little moments that really might not be necessary, or you get the main story. You really let the actors feel the scene out. Let them really, like, get into the zone, experience things. And then in the edit, if you find you need these little moments, these little inserts to really tie things together, you just get those later because you can, and it's fine. And oh my God, that made a world of difference. So, like, the rock climbing sequence, because we were chasing the snow was a huge component of the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to go in and, like the rock climbing sequence, so the climbing up the rocks, like, there's lots of little inserts in there that were, like, very key, and it just mattered, like, depending on which take I wanted, I needed his eye line looking left or looking right, or I needed this start. Like, you really just need to kind of see how it all flows in the edit before you can go in and determine exactly which pickups you need.
Yeah.
So it was great to just do that with the main unit shoot and get it all edited, and within, like, a week or two, we'd go back and just grab a couple little pickups just to make sure we had what we needed. And I'm so, so happy with how that worked out. That was great. So, yeah, being the editor was fantastic. I'm, you know, typically editing in my head as we go. But to really edit and really work with the specific take you choose, and then you can really base off of the eye line or where you cut. Like, does the actor leave camera right or camera left at the end of the shot? That's great. Or did they have a certain look on their face? You just kind of work off that look. Something that's unplanned and unexpected. You're not going to inhibit the actor. You kind of work with what they give you, and then just, like, find the right little shot that kind of just puts the cherry on top, or just gives a little accent to that scene before you cut away. It was so freeing. It felt great to have that option.
Now, the other element that is very important in this film, because so much of this is observational, is your score, is your music. You brought in Joshua Hemming. What were you looking for musically to complement the story and these visuals?
You are very good at this, by the way. I gotta tell you, like, there's all sorts of nerdy little insights that I've, like, thought over and over and over again, but, like, nobody cares about this stuff. I'm like, stop me if I'm blabbing too much, but I gotta say, you're picking up on all these little things that we put days, hours and hours, if not days or weeks into. So again, thank you for asking, but one thing to go with Josh, I gotta say, we did this on the short film. We had a short film called Walking Supply that we based this off of, and again, this was just sort of a happy accident, but I sent him the script before I went location scouting, and that was the best thing I've ever done. In terms of, like, pre-production or prep work was concerned, because I would give him the script, and then he would send me a bunch of work that he had done in the past, or that he thinks feels appropriate, or he cook up some little, like, tracks, like, hey, here's kind of a vibe that I think is sort of the right tone. So I would mention a couple things. There were a couple key musical compositions. There was something from Interstellar that I really liked. There were a couple, like, Hans Zimmer bits, and something from, like, The Raid 2, funny enough. It's this, like, Indonesian film that I absolutely love. Ooh, Indonesia, yeah. And there's a couple, like, key tracks that I thought would work for a couple scenes. I'm like, hey, here's a couple, like, almost, like, kind of like keyframe animation. Here's a couple, like, main little beats that I think kind of feel right. And he would sort of take that and run with it, and then he gave me a soundtrack. So when I went location scouting, as I said, for, like, weeks on end, trying to find just the right spots, I'd be playing the tracks that he provided me, and the movie was just playing out in front of me as I went. And I think that was a really key component, because you hear so many, like, horror stories, really, of directors using temp tracks for their rough cut. And then they provide that to the end. They play the movie to these, like, they edit the whole sequence to these temp tracks, and then they hand it to the composer before the composer has had a single opinion on the matter. And now this composer is just like, okay, that's cute, but that's not what I think this should be. And now you have a problem. Now you have people who really, like, come into this with certain ideas, and they're starting from the wrong page. And that's, like, that's a massive gap that you need to kind of, like, traverse. And then creatively, I think that's a really bad place to start off. With Josh, and we've done this on a few projects now, we're like, right off the get-go, we'll make sure we're on the same page before we ever roll film in any which way, before we shoot a single shot. That way we know that once we get into the edit, we're already on the same page. And then as I'm scouting, as I'm looking, even as I'm writing, as I'm doing rewrites, I'll be thinking about the I'll play the music that he's already provided me, so we know we're on the same page. And I think it really helps us flow. It really helps us, like, get to the final product faster and, like, really just, yeah, make sure we're on the same page. I love it.
Mm-hmm. So now at the end of the day, film is ready. Everybody can now see it. As you look back on this experience of shooting Whiteout from script to screen, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker? Not a stuntman, but as a filmmaker, a director, writer, that you can now take forward into future projects?
You know what, being completely honest about that, I think there were some very disheartening moments. We're going to be fully honest. Overall, absolute dream project, and I can't say how much I love it. Overall, that is completely true. If I'm going to be completely honest with you, though, I come from a world of doing a lot of pre-vis work and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's like we create pre-visualizations for scenes where there's typically four or five of us, or like, yeah, maybe 10 or 12 on a big day. But there's just a handful of us sitting in a stunt rehearsal stage with, you know, cardboard boxes as sets. And then if you need to move fast, we're never worried about lighting. We're never worried about makeup or costumes or anything. And if you want to go fast, you just say, go fast. Everyone moves quicker, and you always make your day because you can always just say, hey, let's give it a little gusto, and it works. And I kind of came from that world. And then all of a sudden you're working with a full crew, and people need to take the time to do their work. And actors, you know, people need to get into the zone. People need to kind of, like, make sure they're feeling the right things. People have questions. Those questions are great. They're going to challenge you on things. Those challenges are fantastic. They make the product better. You know, versus when you're with some stunt guys sitting around saying, hey, say the last thing. No, a question. They need to do it. So I got to say, like, really allowing the artists, whether that be the actors or the key department heads, like the makeup, costumes, anybody, allowing people to have their time to do their work properly, that was a big learning curve. I had to learn to, like, okay, I can't just picture, like, what I can do, because I can't be like, oh, I know if I, like, grit my teeth and go really fast, I can move quickly. Well, that doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that everybody else can move that quickly and rush their process and their craft and their art. Really, like, you want to make sure that people have enough time to do that, because it's a team effort. So I got to say, one big thing was, like, really ensuring that people, every department has the time to do what they need to do, because it's we're all doing the same thing. We're all on the same page. We're all trying to get the ball down the field. And I think it's so important to make sure that everyone's given their space, because, you know, coming from a world where it's like just a couple of us running around with one camera going wild, it's like, man, that was fun. Those are fun days, but that's not what it is working at the feature film level. And you want to make sure that everyone not only has time to do their work, but feels proud of the work that they've done. And obviously you get a product whenever that is the case, and people just feel better at the end of the day too. And so, yeah, I think it was really just like, in my head, sometimes I'd be on a big film set, and I'd be like, wow, things move so slow, why are things moving so slow? Like, well, oftentimes things move slowly because people are taking their time to do things right. That took a bit of learning for me, I gotta be honest.
All right, so that's gonna stick in your brain? It's gonna stick in your brain for the next time?
Oh, absolutely, and I've since shot another feature film that we've shot and we produced, and I think that already I learned, you know, I took that lesson going into it. That aspect worked a lot better, and hey, you learn more lessons every time. It's a learning part of the deal, so always learning how to get better. So that was a big one on Walking Flare, sorry, Whiteout. So that was a big one for Whiteout.
So now, what stage?
Great questions, by the way. You were very good at this. You were so insightful. I'm loving this.
Well, thank you.
Like film therapy.
Oh, good. Tell me, where are you with your next film, with Hunting Grounds? Is it done? Is it ready to come out? Where are you in that process?
Well, Hunting Grounds is cut. Hunting Grounds is complete. With Whiteout, I was a producer, so I was very involved in all the post-production, everything comes to sales. With Hunting Grounds, I was more of a hired gun. I was writer-director, so I don't know where exactly it is in terms of sales and distribution, so I really couldn't give you an exact answer on that, but we're really looking forward to having a crew screening everything, because that was a relatively small film, quick shoot, but we are very, very happy with what we created with the time that we had, and we have absolutely brilliant actors that came out, and we're really happy with what we got there, and James and I are writing our next project as we speak, so I don't think I'm allowed to say much about that one yet, but we're really happy with where that's at. We're just going into the third rough draft, just kind of is, the lessons you learn off of the first one and the second one that we're trying to apply to the third one, just to make it even better. We're really, really happy with what we've got.
I can't wait to see what you bring, in addition to Hunting Grounds, what you and James come up with this other film that you're working on right now. You made a really big splash, a big impression with Whiteout, and I can't wait to see more from you, Derek.
Thank you so much, Debbie. This was an absolutely wonderful discussion. I really appreciate all your questions and your insights and your attention to detail, too. You have an impeccable eye for a lot of the kind of granular details that go into this, and I really respect that and appreciate it. This was wonderful. Thank you.
I'm glad. You're very welcome. You know, it's those granular details and all the people that make them, compose them. Without that, you don't have a film. Or at least you don't have a film that's worth seeing. So,
yes.
But job well done, Derek, and I hope we get to do this again.
I really hope so as well. Thank you so much, Debbie. I really appreciate your time. This is absolutely wonderful.
Thanks, Derek. You have a great weekend. Yes, it's Friday. Weekend! Yay!
It is. Thank you so much, Debbie. Really appreciate it. You too. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.